Karen Lyons is a 31-year-old Fermanagh woman who just a few years ago was planning a new life for herself in Australia when she discovered that she had a very rare lung condition that may have claimed the life of her sister a few years beforehand. Now, in January of this year, she had a double lung transplant. I spoke to Karen as she approaches her six-month checkup.
I was in Australia. I'd been over there for nearly 2 years, and I started to get, well, I'd been quite breathless on and off, and I thought I was just unfit. And I smoked socially at the time. But I came home for a visit to Ireland, and I went to my doctor because I was feeling quite breathless. And she checked everything out and said, no, you just need to exert yourself a bit more. But my sister had passed away 2 years before I went out to Australia, and she had had the lung condition. And I thought, oh, God, I hope I don't have the same thing. But anyway, I went back to Australia thinking, well, my doctor's looked over everything, I'm fine. But I still remain breathless. I'm still trying to do more walking and trying to do more exercise to try and get fitter and get the breathless gone, but it didn't work. But anyway, I was going for my visa to stay, a partner visa to stay with my partner Greg in Australia, and it's routine to get an x-ray. And yeah, so the immigration did the x-ray, and I knew straight away by her face, it just dropped. And I said, you know, is there something wrong with my lungs? She said, yeah, there's a lot of scarring there and it's not consistent, you know, just with a normal girl your age. So you'd need to probably get that checked out. So I went to a doctor in Australia, got a CT scan, and yeah, came back that I had really bad scarring on my lungs, and he said, you know, you're going to have to go home back to Ireland and get that seen too, because I think it might be the same thing as your sister had. So we were back.
And surely at that point you then think, oh my goodness, this is really serious. From being nothing, from actually being told by your doctor things are okay, you think you're a bit unfit to being told this could be life threatening.
Absolutely. I freaked. I just thought, you know, that's me. I'm going to die like my sister. My life's over. And I'm going to have to end my relationship with my partner, Greg, because he won't come to Ireland, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, as soon as I said to him, he said, right, well, when are we going? So we got on a flight, basically, about 3 weeks later back to Ireland. And yeah, we started straight away getting seen by doctors and specialists. And yeah, they didn't really know what was wrong with me because my sister's condition was never fully determined or diagnosed.
And did they tell you what you had?
They said that I had pulmonary fibrosis, which is just scarring of the lungs, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, which means that it's just a general term, basically. You've got scarring of the lungs. We don't really know what's caused this.
So you don't. It's not like something you would maybe get from smoking or nothing that was indicated through your life when you were younger. This was just something that appeared.
Yeah, something that appeared basically in my late 20s. I was completely healthy, absolutely fine, whereas my sister had been sick most of her life. So it was just really, really strange why all of a sudden it had started to, started to develop in me. But then eventually we got referred to a genealogist, actually. Sorry, geneticist in Belfast. And she had a hunch of this certain condition. And she said, I'm just going to run for this test. It has to be sent over to Great Ormond Street in London. And we'll see what happens. And within 2 or 3 weeks, it came back. And she said, yeah, you've got this SMDP2, which is basically a problem with your surfactant in your lungs. I was missing a protein C. I turned out I was the only person in Europe to have it, and it was very likely that my sister would have had the same thing.
The only person in Europe?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At any point do you start to think, oh, my goodness, what have I done? What's happened in my life that's brought me to this point to be this one in millions?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I just thought, you know, I was unlucky enough for my sister to pass away with this, and then me, God, why is this happening to us? And yeah,
given that you knew what had happened to your sister, you'd lost your sister, what was the prognosis for you? Did they say, like, this could kill you, or were they hopeful?
Well, they had nothing to compare, they had nobody to compare it to, because the only other person that we knew that had it was my sister, and she had died. So, we had no other research to compare it to, because it was that rare. We had no one to find to compare to see, you know, how they got on.
That must be terrifying, though.
Absolutely, because I just thought certain death, there's no treatment.
Of course, you would think the same. You'd think, well, you know, your comparison is your sister. It's such a rare thing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, how were you physically at that point? You know, were you able to walk around on your own? Did you need gas and air? How did that work?
Well, I was absolutely fine when I did come back. But then coincidentally, from being back, I started to deteriorate. So I was getting breathless, more and more breathless. And I was having to attend pulmonary rehab up at my local hospital. And, you know, I was amongst all these, well, oldies, really. I was the youngest, probably by 40, 50 years.
What age were you at that point?
I was 26.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, so I start, you know, and I was starting to deteriorate, and then I was having to use oxygen when I was exerting myself. So that was really, really hard to accept as well, being told I had to go on oxygen. I hated it from the moment. I was just determined. I didn't want it, didn't want to use it. But obviously, as I got sicker and sicker, I had to, and then eventually it led to me being on it 24/7 with, oxygen tanks everywhere. And yeah, it was really, really tough to get my head around being so young. I'm from only a couple of years being in Australia, loving my life.
And you had gone from a young woman from Fermanagh, living out in Australia, you know, new partner. Your life is just beginning. You've got over, well, you've had to deal with the loss of your sister and how difficult that must have been. Mm-hmm. And then to be told, right, this is serious, you're going to now need to carry an oxygen tank around with you. Your life will be very limited in terms of what you can do. Were you able to work? How did you function on a daily basis?
I wasn't able to work. When I came back from Australia, we were concentrating so much on trying to get the appointments and get everything sorted. And then by then, when we kind of, you know, realised what I had deteriorated. I was exhausted every day on the oxygen. I was just way too tired physically and emotionally. It was so draining and it was so scary. So I started to go on the spiral of depression because, yeah, as you say, my life had just been ripped away from me. And I was concentrating on and focusing that I was going to die because that's how my sister, you know, that's the way her life went. And
what do you, because we all know that we're all going to die, whether we like it or not, at some point, but we all hope, and for most of us, it's not imminent or possibly imminent. So what do you start to do or to think? Do you start to, like, plan your own death? Do you start to think about saying goodbye to people?
Yeah, absolutely. I considered writing all my letters and putting them away to each person, my family or friends, my goodbye letters, really, and what I hoped their life would be. And, you know, my best friend, she had a baby girl, and I thought, I'm not going to get to see her grow up. And, I remember going up to visit my sister's grave and thinking, I'm going to be buried on top of you. I had it in my head, okay, that was supposed to be for mum and dad, really, in, you know, 30 years, hopefully. But I remember thinking, that's going to be me. I'm going to be put on top of there, and mum and dad are going to be without the two daughters. It's just going to be my brother left. And, yeah, you think all sorts. And, yeah.
How are your family reacting at this point? And your boyfriend, he's Australian, and he came over with you, is that right?
Yes, correct, yeah.
So how are they all reacting to that?
They were all devastated initially. Obviously, you know, we thought, everybody, I guess, their initial reaction was, oh, God, this is going to turn out the same way as Christine. But as time went on, you know, they put on brave faces and they're, you know, everything's going to be fine. You're going to be fine. Don't be stupid. Don't be thinking like that. You know, we're going to get treatment. And, you know, my dad was online every day and emailing doctors from all around the world, trying to get some guidance or, you know, any ideas about therapy, about medication, new drugs, anything. We were just desperate. But because nobody had any interaction or any knowledge about this particular disease, because it's so rare, the genetic disease, it was just really impossible to get anywhere with it.
So at what point then do you become aware, or does the idea of a lung transplant come up?
Yeah, it was mentioned when we first came over from Australia, and I went over to Newcastle and got assessed. But at that point, I was too well to get a transplant. I wasn't sick enough to be listed. So, and I was quite stable then, but even though I was more breathless than what I had been. Then it was last year when I was on the 24/7 oxygen, I was referred again last summer, and I went back over and they assessed me, and that's when they told me, it's time, you have to be listed for the transplant.
Was that something that you thought, great, this is maybe an opportunity to get better? Or did you think, my goodness, things have got so bad, you know, they've not got better, they've got so much worse, now I have to wait and rely on someone else to die so I can possibly have a chance to live?
I spent so long trying to avoid talking about transplant or even thinking about it. I didn't want it. You spend so long trying to keep yourself well, infection free, and, you know, you didn't want to get to the point that you needed the transplant. But then something overtakes when you're so sick and you're basically suffocating all the time, and time keeps going on and you know you're dying, that then your priorities change and you start to think, well, actually, transplant's probably looking really appealing right now.
Because there's no other option.
Yeah, exactly. You start to realise that and you start to accept it. So at that point then I thought, I was absolutely devastated when they told me, because it's just, it makes it really real. And I thought, God, I never planned this for my life. Nobody does. But I thought, well, I am going to die. It's certain death if I don't. So I have to go with it. And yeah.
And did they say to you, right, this, Karen, is going to be 10% chance of getting a set of lungs that will suit you? And, you know, in terms of the chances of it being a success, you'll have to wait X amount of time. What were they telling you?
They told me that on average, people wait up to 18 months, even way longer. It just depends really on the match, the tissue match, the blood match, the size of the lungs, and then just the amount of people that are waiting on the on the list waiting for organs. So there's a lot of factors there, but I thought I would have been on the list, for a lot longer than what I actually turned out to be on it for.
How long were you on the list for?
I was listed officially on the 1st of September last year, and by the end of November, I got really, really sick and was admitted to a local hospital for 7 weeks. I was actually off the list because I was too sick to even be on for a transplant.
So you had gone from you're not sick enough to mm-hmm. you're now too sick. You must be thinking, I can't catch a break here. You know, I just
exactly.
want this new set of lungs and to move on with my life. So what happened next?
I was really, really ill, and it turned out I had a clot in my heart, heart failure, and I had sepsis. So I was in ICU in the Southwest Acute Hospital here locally, and they told me basically, well, they were asking me my wishes on prolonged resuscitation, and I thought, right, that's it, then I'm going to die. Again, that all these feelings started coming back of, and the thoughts of, you know, certain death again, I'm not going to get the transplant. And it's funny, you know, I avoided wanting to be on the transplant list for so long, and then when they told me I wasn't fit for transplant, the worst news for them to come back to me would have been to say, you know, we can't put you back on it. You're basically, that's it. There's no more we can do. But eventually, after the 7 weeks, I was able to build myself up strong enough, and the clot gone and went. And yeah, they were able to relist me back. But at that point, I was so seriously ill. They needed to fly me over to Newcastle and have me physically there on the urgent transplant list and ready to go, because I basically had weeks to live. My body was deteriorating. I was on 15 litres of oxygen. I couldn't even brush my teeth without heaving and just suffocating.
My goodness.
Yeah.
So it's just some small things that we all take so much for granted, like brushing your own teeth. So, how long did you then wait while you were over there until you got that transplant?
I was over there for 3 weeks waiting. It was the longest 3 weeks of my life.
And what happens? Do they come into your room and say, we have a transplant? Or how does that happen?
The day of the transplant?
No, when they tell you that they have lungs there that they can give you.
Yeah, well, I was sitting waiting for my dinner, and a nurse came in and said, don't eat that. And I thought, oh, okay, why are they saying that? And yeah, then all of a sudden the coordinator came through the door, and she said, we've got a potential match for you. And I thought, what are you talking about? For what? Because you kind of forget almost why you're there. And she said, I think there's potential lungs for you, but it's between you and another lady that's on the ward waiting urgently too. But we have to obviously run your tissue and your blood against the donor, and we'll be back basically as soon as we can and let you know. And they were in and out of the room about two or three times. And, you know, this first time she went away and came back and said, basically the lungs are looking really, really good. You know, they're definitely going to be transplanted, but it's between you and the other lady. And then she went back again, came back and said, okay, they don't match the other lady. And she smiled at me, and I thought, all right, okay. Oh, that's sad, you know, because I thought initially, oh, they're not going to be used then. That's really sad. And she looked and she said, well, that means it's you. And I just could not believe it. I just burst out crying. And then, I just gathered myself and thought, okay.
And then they take you in for surgery. And then I would assume that you get very frightened because, and you can correct me here because I am definitely not a professional in this, but mm-hmm. if you get a lung transplant and that does not work, you're dead.
Absolutely.
They can keep you on something to breathe for you, but, you know, how long for? If it doesn't take, or there's a problem in the operation, you know, they take your lungs out. They might be bad lungs, but once they're gone, if the new ones don't work, then that's it. Whereas if you get like a liver transplant, it's maybe a slightly slower process to see if it can take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much. There's so many complications that can happen. And yeah, as you say, when your lungs are gone, there's no turning back. You can't just say, actually, yeah,
put them back in.
Yeah, they're gone. And yeah, they'll try everything with the new lungs to try and make them work. But if they're not going to work with your body, there's just no chance. Yeah, they can keep you on life support and see if they'll take, or, you know, that they can administer more steroids to try and make them stronger. But if it's not going to work.
So do you say your goodbyes then before this, you know, you go into this operation?
Yeah, well, I rang my mum and dad and my brother, and basically told them I loved them. And, you know, well, I said, you know, I was going to be there at the other end and it'll all be okay. But of course, everybody was frightened, and you just think, oh, this is a real huge.
I'm frightened, and I know what happened. So, you know,
I
totally get that. Well, I don't really, but I can appreciate how exciting and traumatic and horrendous it must have been all at the same time. So you go under the knife.
Mm-hmm.
I assume you're asleep for this.
Yes.
you wake up, and then do you remember waking up?
I vaguely remember waking up. I did a lot of research before, so I knew kind of what to expect. And I remember reaching up. I had the breathing tube down me still,
yes,
and reaching my hand up to make sure, you know, to see if it was there. And the nurse panicked, thinking I was going to pull it out, but I wasn't. I just wanted to see if it was there, and thinking, okay, so I'm not breathing on my own. It's the machine that's doing it for me. So, and I remember then going back into sleep and coming out of it again when they took the tubes out, and being able to breathe by myself for the first time.
Now, you have to explain for me how that felt. I know I'm not trying to say one transplant is more important than the other, for example, but if it is a liver or kidney or something like that that you don't feel yourself using, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start to breathe on your own with somebody else's lungs that are now stitched into your body.
Yes.
What was that like?
The most, most amazing and terrifying experience ever, because as soon as the tubes came out, I thought, is this going to work? You know, you want to take the breath, and obviously you're in so much pain and you're so drugged out of it, but all of a sudden I was able to do it. I started to panic initially, and they said, you know, slow your breathing down, it's fine. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I'm breathing, I'm doing this by myself, and I can get the air in and out. It was just
so
surreal.
You couldn't before with your own?
No, couldn't, but absolutely not. And it was just, so surreal.
I want to keep saying, yes, I'm sure it was, and I understand, but I really don't. I don't think you could unless you're in that position, although you're doing a great job of explaining it to us. I don't want to put a dampener on it, but do you think as well about the fact that someone has died, obviously through no fault of yours, but someone has passed away, and through that death, you're being given a second chance, this amazing gift?
Yeah, I always think about my donor, and yeah, I used to think, you know, somebody had to die for me to be able to live, and it's not. They died, unfortunately, just, you know, through the circumstances, how they died. It was nobody's fault. And it's just then how it was gifted out, really, you know.
Do you know anything about them?
I was told it's a 47-year-old lady. That's all I know. I will write, when I write my letter to the donor's family, they can then send me more information and we can go back and forth then. But at the moment, that's all I know, that's just, you know, about her. So
what's next for you then? You've just had have you had your 6-month checkup yet?
I will be having the 6-month checkup next week, actually, a bronchoscopy, just to see if everything's okay, because I've already had 2 bouts of acute rejection. So we're hoping, third time lucky, they'll say that, you're good.
And what does that mean, acute rejection? Is that when you need then more medication to try and battle your body trying to reject these new lungs?
Yeah, exactly. So I'll probably, if I did have more rejection, they give me more steroids to try and dull down my own immune system, which is obviously attacking the new lungs, and then they'll increase my anti-rejection drugs for my body to accept. It's just about finding the balance. So they're both fighting against each other to try and hide these new lungs as my own, really, in my body.
Are you on an incredible amount of medication now?
I am still, not as much as what I was, obviously, initially. I've come off a lot.
Do you have a normal life, kind of, so to speak?
Yeah, relatively normal now. Obviously, I've still got quite a lot of nerve pain, and I'm still tired easily, and it's adapting to my new body and what my new norm is. But yes, I can breathe, I can walk and talk and eat without being breathless. Yeah, it's just about, yeah.
And I assume infection then is something that you've got to prioritise, that trying to avoid that, and what you do, where you go, what you breathe in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would wear a mask if I'm travelling back and forth to Newcastle, because airports, obviously, and airplanes, lots of crowds. I'm always using antibacterial gel and wipes. Anytime I sit down at a table, I'm wiping everything down, chairs. And just, if anybody's sick or has had a cold or a cold sore, I can't go near them. You're not, I'm a lot more relaxed than what I was initially, because I'm not as scared, I guess. Because I'm more in control, I just do it automatically, whereas before I was just so frightened of forgetting to do my hands. And it's just about incorporating that now into my life.
And will you always have to be on medication then? Is that a lifelong thing?
Yeah, it will be for the rest of my life, just so that my lungs just stay happy, really, and don't go anywhere.
how supportive, I think I know the answer to this, how supportive have your family and your partner been since this happened?
Absolutely amazing. My partner, I just couldn't ask for anybody better. He's just been absolutely incredible from, day one that I met him and going through the whole illness.
This is Greg the Australian.
Yes, Greg.
I'm sure he loves being described like that.
Everybody describes him like that.
So you can now start I understand you've still got a bit of a road to go, but you can start to plan now the rest of your life, whereas not that long ago, months ago, you kind of thought it was pretty much over.
Yeah, absolutely. So now, you start to let yourself think of, we can finally get married now, because we've had to cancel two wedding dates. And that was pretty devastating. So now you start to think, we can do that. And maybe, have children eventually, or just travel and go back to Australia, visit his family, friends. Yeah, and then the bucket list is starting to get quite long.
Why talk out about it? What is it you want people to take from your story?
Well, my main thing was initially just for people that are waiting on a transplant, because I was so terrified. I could not find anything on transplant journeys. You do see a lot of maybe cancer journeys being followed with documentaries on TV, and there's just never anything on transplant. And I've had so many people message me since and before and after, that are waiting on transplants, or people that have donated their family's organs. And, they said, you've made it seem less scary and more humanly possible. And, thank you for that, because now I feel like I can do it. And you've just explained some of the processes that we just weren't aware of, or people that have donated their family's organs have just, thanked me, because then they've never met the recipient. So they've said, this is actually lovely to see your walk and proof, and this is the reason why we did it. This is the reason why we donated my dad's lungs, and it's just incredible to get that back. And it's just driving me forward then to try and get more and more people signing the donor registration, because there just isn't enough people.
Karen, it has been a real delight to talk to you this morning. I feel like you're a walking miracle.
Oh, thank you.
And good luck with everything, and I hope you get married soon. And I hope, is Greg the Australian, will he be staying here permanently then, both of you? You're not going to move back to Australia?
No, we'll have to stay here, unfortunately.
Fermanagh, is it? Do you live in Fermanagh now?
Yeah, in Fermanagh, yeah.
He's come from Australia to Fermanagh. I'm sure that's not much of a change, is it?
No, not really. Not in this weather.
Karen, thank you so much. Thanks for talking to us, and good luck with everything.
Thanks very much, Finny. Thank you.
You can follow Karen's story on her blog, which is on Facebook, and it's at My Long Story. Kevin, good morning to you.
Morning, Finny.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to wish that lady there, I've been listening to her interview, and it's a great story. We experienced the same story ourselves. My wife has had pulmonary fibrosis and has had a heart and double lung transplant.
My goodness.
In the Freeman Hospital in Newcastle.
And when was that?
She's in her 14th year.
And how has she been?
She's been absolutely brilliant. I can't keep up there.
Kevin, I'm delighted to hear that, Kevin. Look, thank you very much. There's also a text in here from Margaret and Enniskillen about Karen. Says, you're an inspiration to everyone. I can only wish you all the love, luck and happiness in the world.